agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing pretty well. I think better. Gosh, I always think I have something clever to say, but we're recording early today, so I don't.
That's right. I'm barely out of my
jams. Better than the Justice Department legal team in Washington, I guess. This is how I'm feeling today.
All right. Well, I am. I'm glad to be back with you on the show. I took a couple of weeks off, as you know, and as I was saying to you not too long ago, it was weird hearing you do the show with Jay. I feel like we're sort of like the podcast equivalent of some old married couple, and I saw you having lunch with some other podcast host or something, and it just struck me as odd. So, but Trey's a great guy, you know, but I am
jealousy. Yes.
You know, I think so, actually, the green-eyed monster. But we are back together again to do the show today. So before we do, though, we want to thank some of our newest Patreon supporters, Brian, Andrew, sorry, and Dan, who recently increased his level of support for the show. So thank you all very much. Yeah. And of course, when you're a Patreon,
even in your absence,
there's a connection there. Anyway, but if you're a Patreon supporter, you know the deal. You get that second full length episode every week. And you also get other things like ad free versions of all our shows and other stuff at different levels. Just go to patreon.com/politicsguys to check it out. And also, I should mention that starting this week, it is early, we are trying something new. Instead of waiting until Wednesday to release that bonus episode just for supporters, we're going to have it drop at the same time as our weekend show. And the reason for this is since, you know, more often than not, I think, we cover things in that bonus show that we didn't have time for in the regular weekly episode. I thought it would be more kind of timely to make that discussion available right away. And that way it's available right away also. And if you want to wait until Wednesday, well, you can still do that. So more options, more timeliness. But Jay, as you said, people really want a second hour of us right away? And it may be too much of a good thing. I don't know. But anyway, it's going to be there. We'll try it out. Let us know what you think about it. And as always, if you'd like to hear our weekly bonus show whenever we put it up there and you can't afford to support the podcast financially right now, totally not a problem. Just email me, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up. All right. So today we are going to be talking about a bunch of things, the eviction moratorium, vaccination the status of vaccinations and community spread, and the latest on the infrastructure bill, new pollution regulations from the Biden administration, of course, the stuff going on with Governor Cuomo, sanctions against attorneys filing baseless election fraud lawsuits, whether Jay is truly a defender of freedom and whether he's concerned enough or not concerned enough about the threat of Donald Trump, and also maybe some stuff on health care. So that's a lot. And I am positive a bunch of that's going to spill over into the bonus show. But before we get started with any of that, we are going to take just this quick break and then we will get going. All right, Jay. So let's start with the eviction moratorium.
It's rough doing it a little early.
You know, oh my gosh, my mouth is not working. Anyway, this week, the Centers for Disease Control issued a 2-month extension of the COVID-related eviction ban. And the announcement came after significant pressure from the progressive left, most notably from freshman Representative Cori Bush of Missouri's 1st Congressional District. Now, in May, a federal district court judge ruled that the CDC moratorium, which was put in place after a congressionally enacted moratorium expired, went beyond the authorized powers of the CDC, but the judge stayed her ruling while the government appealed. Then in late July, the Supreme Court upheld the stay, meaning that it allowed the CDC eviction ban to remain in place in a 5-4 decision. But Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who was part of that five-member majority, made it clear that he wouldn't support an extension of the ban. And in his concurring opinion, Kavanaugh said that he believed the CDC had exceeded its authority in issuing the moratorium, but because it was scheduled to end in a few weeks, and that time would allow for distribution of like $47 billion, I believe, in congressional appropriated rental assistance money, he was voting to let the moratorium stand. But he ended his concurrence with this very important sentence. In my view, clear and specific congressional authorization via new legislation would be necessary for the CDC to extend the moratorium past July 31st. And in remarks this week, President Biden indicated that he asked the CDC for other options, and that he didn't really know whether or not an extension would be rejected by the court, telling reporters, "The bulk of the constitutional scholarship says that it's not likely to pass constitutional muster." But the president also said that extending the moratorium, even though it's likely to be struck down, allows for additional time to distribute those rental assistance funds. Because as of June 30th, only around, I think, $3 billion of that $47 billion had been distributed, that was appropriated from Congress, had been distributed. So, Jay, what's your take on this whole situation and the new moratorium and all this related to this?
Yeah, wow. So, Mike, if you remember last summer, I want to say it was last summer, then I always get the question of, back then at least, gosh, Jay, what could President Trump do that would really turn you off, that would really turn you around, that you would say, I can no longer support this guy? And I believe it was somewhere last summer after he issued the initial moratorium, where I came on the show and I said, this could be it. Because I thought then that it was overreach, unconstitutional intrusion into private contracts, and my opinion hasn't changed. When Congress did it, I would still say it was an overreach, but more likely constitutional. But what we have here, you said the federal judge. In the D.C. district, but there have been numerous other federal judges who have also held that this is unconstitutional for the very same reasons. And in fact, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled about 2 weeks ago. So you have one appellate court ruling, again, unanimous appellate court ruling that, yeah, the CDC does not have this authority under its statute. And to be clear, to dig into the weeds a little bit, what the statute says is the director may take appropriate actions to remedy, prevent the spread of disease. And then there's like a list of things, such as quarantining, fumigating, destroying animals, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's this and other measures. The CDC and President Biden and at one point President Trump tried to interpret that and other measures to mean, well, take over, the entire, residential rental economy. And the courts have said, no, when Congress lists has a laundry list and you include a couple things and then you have the and others are meant to, reflect things of the same nature as the list. So that's the basis that the courts have ruled on this, with the exception of, again, if you want to dig into the legal weeds, the district court in Texas actually knocked the whole thing out on Commerce Clause grounds, that even if Congress did this, there still wouldn't be authority to do it. Now, that case is also on appeal. And my sense is that's a bigger stretch. But regardless, I side with that bulk of constitutional scholars who say no, there's no way this passes constitutional muster. So
yeah, I like the fact, I always like the fact that you don't just rely on the media reports of these things, but you actually look at the underlying doc. You're a big fan of the underlying documents, as am I. And for people who are sort of following along, what we're talking about is the the actual legislative authority is Title 42, Section 264. And
you're playing along at home. Yeah.
Exactly. And I looked that up. Now, I interpret it a little bit differently than you do. And I read especially Section A is the one, or Part A is the part that's cited. And it seems to me I wanted to talk about that legal authority issue, because in his concurrence, Justice Kavanaugh specifically signaled out the nationwide ban. And there's an important, I think, potentially, there's an important distinction here. Because with just a blanket nationwide ban saying that, well, you know, we are having a moratorium, there's a moratorium no matter what the level of COVID transmission is. Well, there, it is difficult to say that this is being clearly linked to the stopping the spread of any sort of introduction, transmission, or spread of communicable disease. So, but the CDC changed how it put in place this initial or this subsequent 2-month ban, and they specifically tied it the two only areas that have substantial or high case levels, where in the language of the moratorium, which would be exacerbated by mass evictions. And so it seems to me that, well, it doesn't seem to me, this is in fact more targeted specifically to the CDC's legal authority. And I think, at least, even if you think that the CDC has exceeded its authority, certainly I think it is a closer call than if it's just a blanket nationwide ban.
It's a slightly closer call, but that's like saying, you know, I don't know, your team got beat, you know, 42-0 versus 42-7. You know what
see,
I mean?
Yeah, I don't see it. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I don't see it that way, because as I read Title 42, Section 264, it seems to me that is at least reasonably within the purview of the CDC. And I understand you have a different interpretation. I should point out that it seems to me that your side is the side which, you know, even President Biden and the bulk of constitutional scholars are on. But I guess I'm saying that I don't think on the face of it that it is a frivolous or ridiculous argument, given that the ban this or the moratorium this time was crafted more specifically on, you know, those high transmission areas. That's all.
Right. No, there is more craftsmanship. Let's put it that way. Okay. In this one. But again, as the you know, the numbers are borne out, that number, I think when they originally passed it a week ago, was somewhere around 80%. And now they're projecting, well, being 80% of the country, counties in the country would be covered by it. Now that's something like 87%.
But I'm wondering why that matters.
The scope of the moratorium will increase as the scope of the spread does.
But. And will decrease as it decreases. Yeah. In the end, though, while I'm saying it's a closer call for me, I do still tend to agree that this is a bit of overreach, though for me it's a closer call than it say is for you. And the other issue I wanted to ask you about, and there are some legal scholars, particularly on the right, who are looking at this, have talked about this, is even if you accept this interpretation, even if you'd say, you know, even if Congress say passed legislation, which according to Justice Kavanaugh would be okay, then right, would this potentially constitute a taking and thereby violate the Fifth Amendment's taking clause, which, as you know, Jay, prohibits taking private property for public use without just or fair compensation. And
right,
I know there
that,
are some
yeah.
who make that argument. Well, what do you think? You are a conservative legal authority, at least to me. You
I
are.
Am.
What do you think about that argument?
And actually, no. And again, full disclosure, I filed briefs in the Sixth Circuit case and in the Fifth Circuit case. You know, first of all, I want to hit on a couple other things that you didn't mention about the moratorium.
Sure.
That sort of cut against the, you know, narrowly tailored kind of idea. And this is something that's going back to the beginning of the moratorium, is there are exceptions for things like abusive spouses or criminal acts and so forth. They say, okay, you can evict those people, which makes perfect sense, right? Why would you want to have those people as tenants? But it doesn't make perfect sense if the idea is we have to, you know, we can't evict people because they will spread COVID unless you somehow accept that these people are less vulnerable or less likely to spread COVID because they're being evicted for, you know, drug use as opposed to not paying the rent.
Okay, before you get on to your second point, I guess I would say I see that. I understand that argument, but I think probably a counter and one that I would accept is that there's a balance here and you have to weigh the potential for spread for what would almost certainly be a very small number of people in those instances and the harm that would be directly caused to the potential for spread and the harm that would be caused by that. And reasonable people can come to different interpretations, but I don't see it as being illogical on its face, given that sort of balancing that a test that I would apply.
No, fair, and that's a fair counterargument. The second piece where I think it's a little weird is that, you know, what about people who you no longer have a lease, right? You can have leases that expire. As I would read the moratorium, I think there's no duty to renew that lease, and that puts, you know, another class of people. One, people you're evicting because they've breached the lease, right? They failed to pay. But if the lease simply expires, do you have to keep them? I think most courts would say, and again, I haven't done a deep dive on what how courts have treated these types of cases. Most likely, I think has been held off because courts have said, hey, we're not doing evictions now. But there's also that other weird classification, right, of one group of people could not be evicted, but another could. It just depends on the status of their lease. Which again, there's no connection to the health issue there. But to your question on takings, the way they've gotten around the takings argument so far is in the rules, it said, listen, the rent will continue to accrue and the landlord would still have an action to collect the rent. So the idea in theory is, look, you're not really taking any money from the landlord because they can still recover it. In practice, they can't really recover it though. But that would be the argument that there's no taking because the government isn't not compensating you. They're not saying these people don't have to pay rent. They're saying, well, they don't have to pay rent now. And if they don't, there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, I'm actually a little more sympathetic to the takings argument, maybe than some people would expect, or certainly than more maybe than you are. I don't know, but it seems to me that what you're describing, it's still taking. It's just taking and saying, well, for a while, like taking and then giving back. Yeah. I mean, to me, if I am in the position of a landlord. Especially there are millions of small landlords. I mean, my father was a small landlord, had one or two little properties, and you know, and so there are
40% of the residential rental market the residential properties are owned by people who own like fewer than five properties.
Right. So I mean, and the fact that you are not able to bring in any money while you still have bills and other things due, if that doesn't in any meaningful sense constitute a taking because that's due to a government action that deprives you of your right to collect rental income, it seems to me that then a taking is essentially meaningless, that we're playing word games here.
Yeah. Well, and also I'll just say in the practical real world, the way this works out, you know, in almost landlords collecting on late rent is pretty rare. I mean, a lot of times it just the person just doesn't have it, right? So you keep the security deposit, you evict them, you move on. There's really no good way to get that money back, and I think everybody knows that. But again, there's this kind of fiction that, well, you're not really out the money because well, someone still owes it to you. I'm just saying that's the justification. And I do want to point out that a friend of mine, a friend of the show, forwarded me something last night, an amicus brief that was filed in the new like I shouldn't say the new, the renewed challenge to the new moratorium, which was an amicus brief by the Third Amendment Lawyers Association, challenging this on Third Amendment grounds.
Huh, okay. It's a new one.
And I think I this occurred to me, and I don't remember if I said it on the show. If I did, and I really wish I had. But they make the argument, and it's maybe a little tongue in cheek. But for listeners who aren't playing along with this or don't have their constitutions handy while they listen to the show, the Third Amendment forbids the government from quartering troops in your home, which was a big deal back in 1789, but has become less so today.
Yeah, you don't hear many Third Amendment arguments these days.
Exactly.
You
know? What do you say to a landlord who rents to people who are in the military? Is that landlord not being now required to house troops, to quarter troops? There is very little Third Amendment jurisprudence anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. But I think that's just kind of fun. And it points out a little bit of the ridiculousness of this, too. In that, if you think back of what the framers were talking about, they said, listen, this is, for the government to say you must quarter troops, that's absolutely ridiculous. And now we have the government saying, well, you must quarter anybody. Right. I mean, there could arguably be some sort of reason why the government might require you to house soldiers in your house, particularly in time of war or something like that. It seems less so that you can say, well, the federal government has the power to require you to house anybody for free at any time.
Well, the thing that really frustrates me about this is Congress has had over a month to act on this. The Supreme Court issued its ruling on June 29th. And it seems to me that if Congress were acting responsibly, there would have been a standalone bill that extended the moratorium while at the same time, and this in my ideal world, providing compensation to landlords and not tenants. And I think this is important because right now how it works is the tenants apply for it and there are all these documentation things. And there are a lot of tenants who may not have that. And of course, it seems to me it's a lot more streamlined. And it focuses much more on the main issue if you provide it directly to the landlords. Of course, there are fewer landlords than there are tenants. Landlords, I think, are going to be much more likely to be in a position to and have the incentive to provide documentation, right, to qualify for these payments. And
Amen. Amen.
I just think Congress completely dropped the ball on this. And it's just one more instance where I find myself greatly disappointed that there wasn't anything that happened on this. And so I guess something probably will have to, because it seems unquestionable to me that even in a month, with President Biden said in his remarks that, well, at least this gives us about a month to get this money out. But the fact of the matter is this is not, it's not like you just walk up to the government office and they give you money. You say, hey, I'm a renter. Oh, here's a couple thousand dollars. I mean, it's a bureaucratic process. And like so many bureaucratic processes, it's difficult. And again, if you're a renter, you might say, God, it's a pain in the butt. And I don't know, but I know that I can't be evicted. And so you got to think about incentives. And so I really think Congress was not thinking about what the incentives were and what would make this program work most efficiently when they put it together. So again, Congress.
Ooh, I think they were thinking about incentives.
Well, maybe they were, but in a wrong way then. a lot of people are hurting. Let me be clear.
The point to that is then, assuming the renter goes through all the bureaucratic hoops and collects the money, the landlord still has to chase him to get it.
Yeah.
Right. There's no guarantee that that person, having received their check from the government, will then pay their rent. They might say, hey, free money. Landlord would say, please pay me the rent. And the person would then reply, well, no. And what are you going to do about it?
And so why would you do it through the, it just seems to me to be a unnecessary step in the process. And, but I don't want to point out, there are around 11 million renters in data I saw that are at risk of eviction due to financial hardships. That's a real thing. And on the other side, according to those the Alabama real estate agents who initiated the first challenge on the moratorium, landlords have been losing over $13 billion in unpaid rent every month as a result of this. That's every month. And as you pointed out, yeah. Jay, some of these people are big, or some of these landlords are corporate. I mean, most of them are, but there's a significant chunk that are people that have maybe one or two properties, and you cut them off from that funding, and that
is their retirement income.
Enormous financial hardship, and so this is not me saying, well, you know, the hell with the renters of just evict them. It's me saying that Congress could have done something to prevent this, and they didn't, and I'm hugely disappointed.
Yeah, and I want to throw and you are 100% right on that, and I would also point out that look, these moratorium lawsuits. The court started knocking these out back in February and March, right? Already there were a lot of district courts that had, I think the Texas one was in February, the Ohio one was in March, the Tennessee one that went up to the Sixth Circuit, I believe that was also in March. So it's not even that this problem suddenly popped up in June when the Supreme Court decided not to extend the extend the stay, or decided to allow this stay to exist till the end of the program.
Right.
Congress has known about this for quite a while. But the last piece I want to throw in, this is just real world stuff. Also, on the people at risk of eviction, as an attorney, I've handled plenty of evictions, on both sides, and. The way it works is you usually go into court. You know, the judge says, okay, you're paying the rent. Yes, no. And in most cases, before you even get there, though, the attorneys, the landlords try to work something out, because it's expensive to hire lawyers to go to court to evict somebody. It's a pain. The process is not instantaneous. It's not like, you know, someone just says, oh, you're evicted and you're out the next day. It takes weeks or months, sometimes even longer. And usually, you know, what you do when you go to work stuff out in court is you work out a, you know, scheduled move out date, you know, and give people lead time. Or you find some way to put together a payment plan to keep them in there. Because again, in most cases, it's more expensive for a landlord to go find a new tenant than to evict. You know, they get nothing out of eviction. Tends to be a losing proposition, if you will.
Right.
So
yeah,
it's sort of a last resort to cut your losses.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think it's not the, you know, sort of version that some people may have seen. It certainly can happen, but it's not legal for a landlord to come the day after the rent's due is to, you know, open up the apartment and throw everyone's stuff out and change the locks.
That would be a violation of all sorts of state laws in most every state. And yeah, that's just not how it works. And what the moratorium does, it prevents those other conversations from happening of, hey, can we set up a payment plan? Or hey, can you be out in 2 months? Or that sort of thing. And it also, you know, when everything is frozen, right? When no one can move anywhere, that prevents people from moving into maybe lower price housing.
Well, people can move. It's just the moratorium on evictions. It's not a moratorium on moving.
No. But what I'm saying is those other places would not be opened up, right?
I see what you're saying.
If everybody's staying put, right? The supply isn't there.
So I think in the end, though, the thing that we can completely agree on is that is our great disappointment in Congress for not doing something about this when something clearly could have been done.
Right. And Cori Bush, rather than sleeping on the Capitol steps, should have slept in Nancy Pelosi's office. If you really wanted to make the point, right?
Yeah. I would have been in a way disappointed, Jay, if you hadn't made a Cori Bush comment at some point in the article. Hey, why don't we move on to our next story, also COVID related. But before we do that, just take a quick break and then we'll be right back. So in other COVID-related developments, the Delta variant continues to spread pretty aggressively throughout the country, and students are preparing to return for the new school year. In a few weeks, I'll be back teaching at NKU, where there is a mask mandate, so I'll be teaching in a mask. That should be fun. But this week, President Biden called out Republican governors standing in the way of mask mandates and vaccine requirements, saying, "I say to these governors, please help. But if you aren't going to help, at least get out of the way. The people are trying to do the right thing. Use your power to save lives." And while Biden didn't mention any specific governors in those comments, much of the focus has been on two of them, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Texas Governor Greg Abbott. On July 30th, Governor DeSantis issued an executive order prohibiting schools from imposing mask mandates and directing that all legal means available be used to ensure compliance, including withholding state funds from schools that impose mask mandates. And similarly, in Texas, Governor Abbott issued an executive order, this was back in May, that prohibited any governmental agencies from mandating masks, with exemptions for state-owned or supported assisted living centers, hospitals, and correctional facilities. And right now, around half of all new infections and hospitalizations, at least in the past week or so, were just in seven southern states. Florida and Texas are the leading two, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi, even though those states represent less than a quarter of the U.S. population. And just yesterday, Friday, August 5th, Florida reported more than 22,000 new infections. That's the highest single day number since the pandemic started. And to give you a sense of how things are in Florida, 3 weeks ago, 3,652 people were hospitalized with COVID. Last week, 8,855. This week, this last week, the number was 12,227. It's a 234.8% increase in that period. So, what do you think about this, JR? Are these governors particularly focusing on, it seems like DeSantis has most of the focus, are they doing the right thing or is there an issue here? Is President Biden right? What do you think?
Well, you try and I kind of hit on this last week do people do what their politicians tell them or do politicians do what the people tell them? And I tend to think it's more the latter. So I guess the question is, yes, should more people get vaccinated? Absolutely. Should these governors be out there promoting, hey, you ought to get vaccinated? Absolutely. Should they be mandating vaccinations or masks? Well, there I start to fall off a little bit because I'm not sure that it is sort of an intrusion. And second, I'm not sure what good it does at this point, right? I mean,
maybe we can separate out these issues, Jay, because it sounds to me in your response, you're talking about three, at least as I count them, three separate things. One is encouraging vaccination and mask usage. It's sort of trying to lead by example. The second thing is having mask mandates. The third thing is having vaccine mandates. And I'd say a fourth thing is actually prohibiting those mask mandates from lower governmental levels. And so they're not all the same thing. And I think it's important that we sort of disaggregate those things.
I think that's right. Yes.
And maybe we start with sort of the most intrusive thing. And I think we can both agree that the most intrusive sort of government action is telling people that they have to get a fully approved vaccine. As a consequence of being a resident, so
being alive,
right?
Yes.
That is
my body, my choice, Mike.
Yeah, that is the highest level, right? And now nobody is I'm aware at this point is mandating or no governmental agency at this point is mandating vaccines. Now that's going to change once one of the vaccines is approved, and the Pfizer vaccine is supposed to be, FDA is hoping to give it approval by Labor Day, I think. And once that happens, there are a number of universities, and many of those are, some of those might be state institutions. The Defense Department.
You'd still have subdivisions.
Yeah.
And states states imposing a requirement on their employees, which is a little different than states imposing a requirement on citizens in general.
But that is to come. That certainly will come once we start to see regular FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine and then some of the others. So, but that's kind of for a future discussion. But let's move on to the issue of not just discouraging vaccine mandates at lower levels of government, but telling lower levels of government, if you're the governor, you can't do this, in fact. So banning vaccine mandates from lower levels of government that are presumably closer to the people and the situation and would know better. And we've talked in the past about these concepts of, you know, subsidiarity and so forth. And I think it sounds to a lot of people, at least on the left, that particularly Ron DeSantis is just trying to gin up the Donald Trumpist sort of anti-vax base. And as a result, you know, it's like one out of every five cases of COVID is coming out of Florida. And this is actually costing people, you know, health and in some cases their lives to serve Ron DeSantis' political ambitions.
Well, again, I think that's where you kind of lose me a little bit, right? And if you want to, on the first part of what you just said, as far as is this DeSantis being a political and trying to rev up the base? Yes. That doesn't mean that there's not an actual concern there, though, too. I am sort of part company from DeSantis on this as sort of an old school conservative local government type person. Right.
I thought you might.
My sense is. You know, I think if those local decisions ought to be left to local authorities, and if you want to fight it out over, you know, whether your kid has to be vaccinated to go to school, if they're old enough to be vaccinated, then, you know, show up Monday night at the school board meeting and give them hell.
Yeah.
That's just sort of a philosophical sort of, you know, the lowest level, most accountable level. And look, let different communities decide for themselves what's best for those communities. So I'm not crazy about that, you know, a state saying putting out those kind of blanket orders.
Right.
At least, you know, in this circumstance. Now, you know, I think there could be room a couple, you know, in other circumstances. Sometimes I do think the state needs this overstep. What the locals are doing. But I just don't think this is one of them, right?
And it would probably be more in the other direction. I would argue that when there is a significant danger to public health, they would overstep maybe in that other direction. But I thought you would probably come down that way because I know you are a big fan of, you said, showing up at the local, you know, the local school board meeting and letting people in that area make decisions for themselves whenever it's feasible. So, well, let me ask you. Oh, go ahead.
But you know, on the other piece of this, and this is what Trey and I talked about last week. You know, he raised the issue of, well, by doing this, by putting in these non-mandate mandates, if you will, you know, does that, he described as this presents a barrier to vaccination or mask wearing, which to me left me just completely sort of, you know, nonplussed, which means confused. Because it seems like, look, no, the government isn't stopping you from getting a vaccination. In fact, they're encouraging it. In fact, you can get it at any corner CVS. You can, right? I mean, we're not in that stage that we were 6 months ago, 9 months ago, where, you know, no one knows who's going to have the vaccine where and all that kind of thing. It's readily available everywhere for free. So I don't see this as the government standing in the way.
And the same thing for masks. You can wear, if you want to wear a mask.
Yeah.
Not that the governor is saying that no one can wear a mask in a classroom or anything like that.
Exactly. Yeah. I would say that is absolutely that. Some, if they were to pass something like that, I would say that's absolutely ridiculous.
I think the point, and I listened to, like I said, I listened to last week's episode. I think the point Trey was getting at, and this gets to your argument about the extent to which people follow government. My sense was that Trey's argument was more along the lines of, well, by doing this, the governor is sending a signal that masks aren't needed and you don't need, you know, you don't need to wear them. So I think that's what he meant by being a barrier, not actually a barrier in fact, a barrier in law, but more, right. more discouraging the wearing of masks. I think that, right. that was my,
it's my mind. Again, if words mean stuff, then barrier isn't the word to use then. But it's, so I guess that takes me to the next point that we sort of talked about is I think these governors, I mean, if you look, you know, this is the South, right? This is the way, I mean, do you think these conservative Southern governors are more persuasive in persuading their people not to do this than, say, Northeastern governors are persuading people to get vaccinated or to wear masks? And I would say, no, it's a matter of, that's sort of the innate place of where that population is, right? You're going to have more resistance in places in the South. It's a cultural thing. And as we say a zillion times, politics is downstream from culture. This isn't I don't think the attitude comes from the governor. I think the governor's attitude reflects the attitude of the people, right or wrong. I mean, these people are completely wrong, completely ignorant, but I think that's the way it goes, yeah, right?
I think you and I probably disagree to a certain extent about how much leadership can move public opinion, but we do agree in the sense that it's predominantly culture and leadership. If it's going to do something, in most cases, it's probably going to be a marginal effect because those cultural attitudes are so baked in. So you and I, again, it's a matter of where we both stand on that scale, I think. But one other thing I wanted to ask you about is sort of, as you know, as listeners probably know, this last week in New York City, while not mandating vaccines, became the first U.S. city to require proof of at least one dose of vaccine for a bunch of activities like indoor dining, using gyms, going to the theater, that sort of thing. And that's similar to programs that were recently put in place in France and Italy. And also, it's also similar, at least has some similarities in my mind, to President Biden's requirement that any federal civilian employees who aren't vaccinated will have to submit to regular COVID testing, social distancing, masking, and other and a bunch of travel restrictions. So I wanted to get your take on this sort of approach to, I guess I'd call it incentivizing vaccination. It's a pretty strong push in that direction. But what do you think about what New York City is doing? And, you know, again, I think that has some relationship to what President Biden is requiring for civilian employees.
Well, you know, so I would start with the premise that a private place of business ought to be able to do what it wants up to the point that's you know, isn't inconsistent with people's civil liberties. So I think if a restaurant or a concert venue or someplace like that wants to say, listen, we're only going to allow you in here if you can provide proof of vaccination or what have you, or if you wear a mask, fair enough, right? If you do, you know, their place, their rules. So I'm okay with that. I start to get a little queasy the closer the government gets involved in this, right? Because that's, you know, it's for the government to encourage those places or to, you know, the government shouldn't be able to accomplish something that it can't do constitutionally by enlisting the private sector to do it instead.
I guess
Facebook, but that's it. So that's where I start to get queasy. And the other issue, and this is difficult, and this is something that makes COVID difficult. And a lot of conservatives, like me, see, look, there's needs to stand on principle at some point. Because you can say, look, yeah, this makes sense during COVID, but where are we going to be the next time around, right? If the government can do this, if the government will encourage this sort of thing, you could certainly make the argument a couple years down the road. Look, the flu kills thousands of people a year, many of them children. You can get severe flus. should you be banned from some place if you can't show proof that you got your flu shot? Right. That's it's the slippery slope. And you always say I'm overly concerned about slippery slopes, but
I do.
I think you
have less faith in, or oftentimes it seems to me like you have a lot of faith in democracy, more so than I do. But in this case, it seems like you have less, because of course there is that level of accountability, because if the city government in New York put in place a measure saying that you needed to be vaccinated against influenza to do all these things, presumably if that became too onerous, whatever the requirement is, the people would rise up and push back against it. But I guess you'd hope so.
Yeah.
And so that's how it, in fact, there's actually more ability to do that when you're talking about government in a way than if you're talking about private businesses, especially if you're kind of, locked into some businesses' infrastructure for various reasons, because
I think you're right. It depends on the business, though, because sure, the pressure that comes to bear on government typically only comes around once every 2 or 4 years. Pressure that's brought to bear on a business hits immediately, right? If nobody's going there anymore, it hits them in the pocketbook right away, as opposed to the next election cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds to me your quizziness is based less on this being unconstitutional, but more on it just being governmental overreach that may be legal, but is inadvisable.
I think that's right. I think that's a good description.
I don't think
there's a constitutional problem here at this point about what we're talking about. Now, if you had something like a vaccine mandate, that just by virtue of being a citizen, you have to be vaccinated or you'll be sent to jail or something. I think that would be a constitutional problem.
Yeah.
But less so. Again, this has been, litigated and ruled on years and years and forever that, look, if you want to send your kid to public school and public school has the right to say, look, they have to have these vaccinations before they start. That's kind of reasonable. And that's been the law for forever. And I don't see that changing as far as a constitutional matter, but the laundry list of things that you might have to do or papers that you might have to show places, I think that's troubling.
Right. And I think one could argue especially troubling given that even though, the scientific community has a lot of faith in these vaccines, that they still only do have emergency use authorization. And there's a reason why there's a process that takes, even when you super rush it, at least half a year, because we don't know long-term side effects. And I understand that obviously has to be weighed against the clear and present danger of COVID. But, the situation, the picture changes, I think, for me at least, once Pfizer and Moderna and these other vaccines have full authorization, and then it becomes a little easier for government to put in place a stronger requirement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
So,
I would just throw out one more thing on vaccines, and this is sort of, again, I'll say thought experiment, and that sometimes not everyone understands what I mean by that, but something that has occurred to me is that, obviously it's crazy that, the conspiracy theories of, they're injecting a microchip in me and they'll be able to track me and control me and all that stuff. Well, it's crazy tinfoil hat nonsense. But 20, 30 years down the road, it might not be. Right. And I can conceive of, so one day, whatever, Microsoft or whomever comes out with a product and they say, look, we can inject you with this, this microchip, this will, regulate all these diseases. This will, prevent all sorts of things. This will be able to, if your children get lost or kidnapped, you'll be able to find out where they are. There's all kinds of really good reasons, why we ought to do this. At that point, does one refuse? And then, on what ground, right? If we've ceded the ground all the way up to that point.
The right to privacy in the Constitution, right?
I
see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. As Jay careens down the slippery slope.
Conspiratorial, but, and saying there's microchips in the vaccine, and that's, of course, not what I'm saying.
Sure, no. I know you're not saying that at all, but yeah. All right, well, I think we can, we at least it would be weird to not have a show, at least in the last few months, without talking about infrastructure, at least a little bit. And so, but before we do that, we're going to take one final quick break, and we'll be right back to talk about infrastructure. So, Jay, you know, the last time you and I talked about infrastructure, the prospect for a truly bipartisan deal, I think to you at least, seemed sort of remote. But since then, you know, it's become more promising, right? Late this week, Chuck Schumer, majority leader, filed a cloture motion to break the current filibuster. And a number of sources say that it's really a question now, not so much of if, but when this is going to pass. And even Mitch McConnell, who previously said that he is 100% focused on stopping President Biden's agenda, has said of this infrastructure bill, there's an excellent chance it will be a success story for the country. That's Mitch McConnell.
Now that's your boy.
There you go. Now that's roughly $1 trillion.
He's now only 80% focused on stopping the agenda.
100%, and that's his words. You know, anyway, it's a roughly $1 trillion measure, $550 billion in new spending, and recently, just this last week, it was scored by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Committee with increasing the deficit by $256 billion over 10 years. Now,
it had been sold as budget neutral, that right. It sort of paid for itself.
Right. So the CBO says, I said, Congressional Budget Office, sorry, said no, $256 billion over 10 years. Now, that could result in maybe a few Republicans kind of pulling back, because as you pointed out, the negotiators on both sides argued that it would be pretty much budget neutral. And the big issue was how CBO and Congress viewed the savings from repurposing COVID funds. The lawmakers said, well, this is going to save around $210 billion over 10 years. CBO said, nah, only $13 billion, which is a pretty big gap there. So,
right. And if you look at, and again, I'm not an accountant, but so much of what they're doing is this sort of accounting magic where they're claiming savings for money that's sort of already been spent, or money that you're just using for something else. So you're sort of double counting.
Yeah, it gets very in the weeds.
Even Paul Krugman, a former Enron economist advisor, has called accounting chicanery. Although he's for it, he said we ought to see more chicanery. Let me ask you this.
So it seems like this is going to happen, and it seems like there's a very strong likelihood that even by the time maybe some listeners hear this episode, that the filibuster, the cloture motion
may already be too late.
Yeah. So what do you think changed? Because a few weeks ago, I mean, when I asked, you know, I asked you and you said, you think this is going to be bipartisan in any meaningful sense? Your sense, as I recall, was not going to end up happening. So what do you think changed where even Mitch McConnell says, yep, we're doing infrastructure?
So my sense there was based on the fact that McConnell seemed to have gotten burned by Biden, who said, okay, yeah, here's the deal, and this will pass so long as you also pass the next big spending plan, the anti-poverty piece, which is now proposed at $3.5 trillion. So do I think this gets through the Senate? Yeah, I do. And maybe Republicans just felt the need to feel like they were doing something. And again, infrastructure, the word infrastructure is very popular. And the idea of fixing highways and bridges and all that sort of thing is something that a lot of people think, including myself, that's a appropriate function of the government. But what this does, and I think as the details come out, you might see more resistance of this roughly $1 trillion. As I'm reading, about 23% or $127 billion goes to that sort of traditional infrastructure, right? Fixing the highways, fixing waterways, you know, all that sort of thing. There is a big piece that goes to public transit. There's like $66 billion to Amtrak, which again, you guys love your trains. but you know, I think there's another $21 billion earmarked for environmental remediation, which again is a little fuzzy. and 50 billion, you know, is also to assigned to a fuzzy category called climate resilience. I think as this comes out, you may see more Republicans have cold feet about it. Now, does that change the Senate vote? Yeah, I don't know. But the other interesting piece is this still has to get past the House. And I don't know that Nancy Pelosi, who has said she wants it tied to the anti-poverty piece, will pass it. I mean, she said she's not going to give it a vote unless the Senate passes the $3.5 trillion anti-poverty piece. Now, that's probably a bargaining position, right? That you can get that reduced. But I still think that's going to be a bigger problem than what
I mean,
what you're anticipating.
I mean, the Senate's going to pass that just because they're going to do it under reconciliation rules, that $3.5 trillion. So that's
that was Trey's point too. But to get to reconciliation, they still need to get to 50. And I don't know that they do as things stand right now.
It might not be. Yeah. And it might end up being $3.5 trillion because there are a couple of more moderate conservative, you know, Democrats that you have to persuade. But it's going to be something, you know, I think. But let me ask you this. So some people might think that.
Well, I mean, I guess that's the question, right? I mean, if Pelosi is saying, I don't give this a vote unless I get the $3.5 trillion. You know, it's where does she at what point does she draw the line and say, I'm just not giving a vote unless it's, you know, what's the drop dead number?
Yeah, I think.
And can they get that? Can they get 50 votes for that?
See, I think, you know, Pelosi follows her caucus. And I think that the votes are going to the support's going to be there in the Democratic caucus. Now, some might say, well, you know, the squad has become emboldened, you know, Cori Bush and the whole thing about the moratorium. And, you know, and certainly I would argue that the progressive left is a greater voice in the Democratic caucus than it has been. But I think that the manifest benefits of an infrastructure bill that has real bipartisan support are going to be great enough to overcome that. And maybe there are going to be a few votes, Democratic votes, against this. And I think Pelosi is going to be fine with allowing those so long as it squeaks through. But I think it will. I think it will squeak through with a few extra votes. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, AOC, Cori Bush, a few other people vote against it, saying it's not enough. And, you know, Pelosi behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah. I don't disagree with that. I guess my question is Pelosi going to make good on her pledge that she's not going to bring that to the floor unless and until the Senate passes the big anti-poverty piece?
Yeah, and I guess she
I agree. The Democrats can get the votes in the House. I don't think they can get the votes in the Senate for the 3.5. And if the two are tied together, as Pelosi has proposed, then that's sort of a problem for both of them.
Well, and to be clear, the two cannot be or are not being tied formally. They are not the same piece of legislation. So I think we need to be clear about what we mean by that word tied. They're not tied in any legislative way. It's not the same bill or anything like that. There's not a specific clause in one saying that the enactment of this is contingent upon the passage of another. This is just an informal sort of thing. So the word, you know, it's contingent, but only in a political way. And again, my argument and Trey's argument.
But it's a political process. And at the end of the day, it's still the speaker who gets to determine whether the bill goes to the floor.
Right. And in the end, both of these things are going to pass. The infrastructure bill is going to pass with real bipartisan support. And then after that, the 3.5 or somewhere maybe less than that trillion is going to pass with no Republican support. And I think that's where we will be. But let me ask you a strategic question. Mitch McConnell is well known for being a master strategist, right? Someone who I would certainly argue has much less concern about policy than he does about doing everything he can to ensure that Republicans have as much power as they possibly can in the Senate. And some would say that, well, this is very smart by Mitch McConnell because this demonstrates going forward that the Senate doesn't need to end the filibuster to make big things happen. So he gives, in a way, Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, you know, cover to say, well, what do you mean we have to end the filibuster because the Senate is complete lockstep? Look, we passed a $1 trillion infrastructure measure, the biggest infrastructure plan in, you know, a long time. And we did it with bipartisan support. So boom, that ends the discussion in any real way of eliminating the filibuster. What do you think about that?
I think you're really thinking there. You're firing all cylinders. That sounds like some sort of cynical thing that I would say.
But it also can be an argument, a real argument, because in fact, if the Senate does do big things without eliminating the filibuster, that does in fact prove that big things can't be done without eliminating the filibuster, even if it's done because in part of the threat of eliminating the filibuster, if you follow me. So it can be cynical accurate, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, and also it then Mitch McConnell can then raise funds for Senate candidates who can completely vote against the 3.5 or whatever trillion. He can go out and fundraise and say, look, this is why we need a Republican Senate to stop this crazy spending spree.
Right. Right. So, and you know, pulling back.
Well, I mean, part of this is knowing the ground and knowing where you're going to win and where you're going to lose. And, it's one of those, George Washington, lost more battles than he won, but, he picked the right ones to win and the right ones to pull out of. And this may be one. I'm still questioning whether Democrats can get the 50 votes on the numbers they're talking about now.
Yeah, and I think that's reasonable.
Let's put it this way. Will they get 50 votes at some point? Yes.
Yeah.
But I don't think at the numbers they're talking about now. And I guess the question is, how serious is Nancy Pelosi on holding to those numbers?
Right.
And how serious is like the left part of her caucus to holding to those numbers?
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. It seems like we both agree that both of these things will pass, though, with the real question is what the final numbers will look like, but they're going to be big. Certainly we know that. And, moving back to policy, it seems to me, what's clear to me, that anyone who looks at infrastructure spending in the United States, it's not a pretty picture. Right? It's been in, if we look at it in terms of a percentage of GDP, it's been in pretty steep decline since that sort of mini boom that followed the financial crisis. And right now, infrastructure spending is just over 2% of GDP, which actually is a record low. I was able to look at numbers from far back as the early 80s, and it's never been that low. And that's a real problem. It seems to me that it's worth considering it. And maybe there are some downsides to this, but having a certain baseline of infrastructure maintenance spending in mandatory spending as opposed to discretionary spending. What I mean by that, for people who don't know the distinction, is that it would be automatic unless Congress specifically voted to cut it, like Social Security is, for one big example. Because it seems to me, Jay, that maintenance particularly is one of the easiest things to cut because the effects aren't immediately apparent. And it's not spending that gives you anything, new and shiny. And that's exactly the reason I look outside right now at my driveway. I have this big, long drive. Our driveway is 110 yards long. It's ridiculous. And it's a mess because I've put off the maintenance spending on getting it resealed and all that. And now I'm regretting that. If only it were automatic spending, then I wouldn't be looking at a multi-$1,000 driveway repair job, and that's how infrastructure is, in a way. And I think there's something to be said for building this in automatically as opposed to just waiting and waiting and waiting until we're at a point where we have just huge infrastructure, real physical infrastructure deficits. GAO a few years back said that almost a quarter of all bridges in this country are structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. And so I don't know. What do you think about that sort of kind of protecting Congress from itself in a way, in the same way that I wish I protected I put aside some money for regular driveway maintenance?
Well, I'm not crazy about any putting the economy, putting Congress's role in this in sort of autopilot, right? Because I think what you do is you just keep ratcheting up the spending year over year. Always and forever, and that's a problem. Look, I think if we want to have a representative government, then yeah, people should be able to come back to their constituents and make the case of this is something we need to do. And I would rather see Congress making those arguments, being the case of, look, let's fund this needed infrastructure. Let's fix the bridges. Let's fix the roads, as opposed to, hey, here's a you know, $50 billion for climate resilience.
Yeah, no, and I think those are good
points. Look, let's hold their feet to the fire. And it happens, right? I mean, when the roads start getting bad, people do complain. People do say, look, this is ridiculous that our airports are falling apart and our, so.
But I mean, that's the problem.
I don't like things that alleviate the pressure on Congress, if you will.
It seems to me that's the problem specifically with infrastructure, just like with in another domain, healthcare, that oftentimes preventative maintenance, yet doing things before they become problems and noticeable problems, actually ends up being a lot less expensive, a lot less hazardous than waiting until they are real problems. And that's exactly the time at which oftentimes these things don't get done. It's like, the road's okay, or the bridge is okay. But you know that in X number of years, it's not going to be the case. And that repair is going to be so much more expensive than if you just simply taken care of the basic maintenance in the first place. And that's what I'm saying. You know, Trey,
I think that's part of responsible government. I'm just, I'm just against putting things on autopilot.
Well, yeah, and I think there's a point to be made, not completely on autopilot, but
with those improvements, sometimes you're going to need the money, sometimes you're not. Right.
Well, that's my point. Yeah. But I think you can design it in such a way.
The money just keeps coming in, and well, we need more, and it's sort of the baseline effect, right? You say, well, look, this is the baseline of what we need to spend. And, you know, if it's any less the next year, well, you're slashing budget for infrastructure. And, you know, that's the problem I have.
Well, I think there's a way to design a regular appropriation for infrastructure so that it wouldn't be that kind of boondoggly sort of, because there is just a real baseline of maintenance that is just absolutely necessary. And it's pretty clear that in many instances, that absolutely necessary baseline maintenance, that's not bridges to nowhere or anything like that, is not being done. So I think a large part of it is how one crafts the legislative language. And maybe you think that it would be done in such a way that it would be a boondoggle. And certainly there's plenty of precedent to suggest that, you know, you may be right in that. But to me, the sort of the devil would be in the details there.
So let me just, this is just a local sort of example. I've got, I live on a street that it's a fairly wide street, but fairly high traffic, I guess. But it's very pretty. It's near the lake. It's, you know, so a lot of people ride their bikes. So we recently put in, not we, I mean the city, put in these bike lanes on this road, which I love riding bikes. I think it's great. But the problem is in most places of the roads, it's not really wide enough for a bike lane, especially two bike lanes, and they change the parking. And it's now just really sort of a mess, and you're swerving all around, and you have people who ride 3x3 in the bike lane and halfway. So it wasn't well thought out. And I said something to a friend of mine who's a city council member, and I said, geez, this bike lane's just a mess. You know, did anybody think about it? And he's like, well, you know, what's the county gave us money for it. And that was sort of the rationale. Well, look, the county said, we'll pay you money if you put in this bike lane. And again, that the county money flowed from some federal infrastructure plan at some point. But, you know, what we ended up with is really sort of a weird and I think in a lot of cases dangerous sort of situation. Because, well, here we had some money, we better spend it on something. Now, it could have been spent on something better, but then someone locally said, well, you know, bikes save the environment, so let's put this.
Sure, and I don't disagree.
And that's my kind of thing, is if you just have this automatic spending, then people get the money. It's not necessary that they're going to do something smart with it or do what you hope that they do with it.
Well, you're right, But I think,
you would
again,
just make sure there's enough strings attached.
Yeah. And that now, of course, and I recognize that almost invariably, you can never attach enough strings because there are always loopholes around it. And so that is a fair point. And that's why I just sort of threw this
The other thing is for local people at the county level, they say, well, we opened up, more bike lanes for access to ride along the lake and tree lined streets and all that. And everyone says, yay, that's great. Again, when you maybe could have used that money to fix the potholes.
Sure. Yeah. And again, it's a matter of how the language is crafted and so forth. But it is, I think we can both agree that we come back to this theme because, well, I think there's a good reason, is that Congress acts irresponsibly or doesn't act quickly enough on many important things. And it's frustrating. And I think maybe the instinct on my end and in part on the left is to make that more of an automatic thing. And the instinct on the right, especially on the libertarian right, is to say, well, people should just behave better and be more rational. And that gets to, I think, you and I oftentimes have that disagreement about,
insist on better governance from their representatives.
Yeah. And so I tend to think that's somewhat of a fool's errand, but I understand what you're saying. So anyway, we've gone a little bit long and we did not get to the new Biden pollution rules or anything about Governor Cuomo or all those other things, whether or not, Jay, you are in fact a defender of freedom or whether you are ignoring there have been some people in the last week who said that I should stop calling you that. We're very upset and have a lot to say about you and Donald Trump and all that. And all that stuff we are going to talk about. We are going to talk about in the bonus show, which we'll be recording in just, probably about 3 minutes, in fact. And again, this week it will be available right away at the same time. We're trying this out as an experiment. Let us know. If you want to get the bonus show and you're not a supporter, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys and you can sign up and get it. And again, if you would like the bonus show but you can't afford to support the podcast, send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make that happen. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please do. And ratings and reviews help, as well as sharing episodes on social media. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, mail@politicsguys.com is our email address. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you will find links to those in our show notes. A special thanks to our most excellent executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.